So we begin by checking in with our posture if we haven't already, making sure that our spine is straight, including the neck, and that our body is otherwise relaxed, that we're sitting comfortably, that we're grounded with our feet on the floor and our hands on our thighs or in the meditation mudra. Our gaze can be in the Shine gaze for now, which is looking down beyond the tip of the nose, unfocused, or we can have our eyes closed if you find that better, especially with a computer screen in front of you. So we begin with the, we'll begin with the four thoughts, just bringing them to mind. We all know what they are now, so I'm just going to say the name of each one, and with a pause, we'll just let that sink in. So remembering and appreciating the precious human existence, which we all have. Remembering impermanence and death. Remembering the law of karma, that our future is determined by our present actions. And remembering that all of samsara is imbued with suffering. All our samsaric experience contains suffering. And our goal is to free ourselves and others from that. And now we'll visualize the Lama or the Buddha in a body of light on a lotus and moon seat above the crown of our head. We can think that everyone else has one too. And the Lama or the Buddha is beaming down upon us, smiling, happy that we're doing this practice, radiating love and compassion and wakefulness. And we just informally in our mind request the blessing from the Lama or the Buddha that these same things, the same level of awakening may arise in our own mind as well. We can think that we mix our mind with the Lama's or the Buddha's mind. Same mind, it's just the mind of enlightenment. And we can think that we have received the blessing of the Lama, the Buddha, and visualize the form that's been above our head, descending through the crown of our head and coming to rest in our heart center, continuing to radiate love, compassion, and awakening all the time whenever we remember to notice that he or she is there. And now we turn our attention to the breath, just following the breath or resting in open awareness if you prefer, just to bring our minds into a gentle focus and a relaxed, settled state. If you're feeling particularly, if your mind is particularly unruly and hard to settle, you could count a few breaths. And this brings us right into Ken's meditation, where he begins by asking us to follow our breath for a few slow, relaxed breaths, just as it is, breathing naturally, letting the mind and body settle naturally. Thich Nhat Hanh says that whenever you need to settle your mind, three mindful breaths is all it takes. So now we'll begin the meditation on ultimate bodhicitta, connecting with the nature of mind through looking at our mind and its various internal phenomena. So bring a thought or image to mind, a word, phrase, picture, or sound. So take a moment to decide what you're going to bring to mind. If you don't have an idea, it could be an image of Chinrezig. And then having generated that thought or that image, we examine where it is. Where is that thought? Where is that image? Where does it exist? And this is a very gentle looking. It's not an examination. It's not an analysis. It's not figuring it out. Not a thought process. Just looking. Like, where do we see that thought? Where is it? Or that image? Is it in our head? Is it outside our head? If it's in our mind, Ken says that's true, but what does it mean that it's in our mind? Where is it? And not straining ourselves to come up with an answer, but just looking to see where it appears to be. And Ken says, it is there, the image or the thought is there, it is vivid, but where is it exactly? And he instructs us to take another few mindful breaths, letting go of the image or thought. And now bring it to mind again, or a different image or thought, and look at it again, but without any thinking, without any thought process. Don't try to figure it out. Just look. Where is it? Where is it located? You cannot say. So knowing that you cannot say, just rest there in the not knowingness, in the cannot sayness, in the not trying to find an answerness. Just rest there, continuing to look and resting in the looking. Very gentle looking, just like what Trungpa Rinpoche says about any object of Shinne meditation. It's as light as a butterfly on a flower. It's not glued down. So now letting go of the image or thought, taking another couple of mindful breaths to sort of clear the decks. Now bring up a feeling or emotion, bring up a feeling of anger or irritation, a feeling of love or joy or grief or anxiety, maybe whatever you've been dealing with today. Just lightly bring it to mind so that you remind yourself what it feels like. And again, we ask, where is it? Where is this feeling, this emotion? Where does it exist? We may notice physical sensations associated with it, and we ask, is the emotion the same as the physical sensations? Where is the emotion itself? We just look gently, not judgmentally, not getting frustrated in any way, but just looking with curiosity. And resting in that, a restful, relaxed looking. We cannot say where it is. No one can. So we just continue to rest there, looking and resting. And if it dissipates while you're looking, that's fine. Just continue to rest. You don't have to bring it back. But sometimes emotions and thoughts are very persistent. And when they're persistent, then we can look for a long time. And when they're not persistent, then once we've looked and they've dissipated, we can just let it go and continue to rest in whatever is left. So taking another couple of mindful breaths, letting go of the emotion. And if you're left with any residue, don't worry about that. We'll just go on to the next thing. And now you'll need your eyes open for this. Look at an object, anything that's within your field of vision. It could be the computer screen or a picture on the wall or a lamp. Just look at it gently. Be aware of it and ask, where is the seeing taking place? Where is it that we're seeing this object? Is it inside the head? Is it outside? Is it where the object is located in space? If it feels like the seeing is taking place in our head, if the object is larger than our head, how can the seeing be in our head? And if you read the story of Millerup and the Yak Horn, that will have enriched our understanding of what that means. If we think that the seeing is taking place in our mind, it is taking place in our mind, but where is that? Where in our mind is it taking place? Where in our mind do we see this object? Or as R.E. Goldfield said in a teaching, where does our mind end and the object begin? And again, we're not trying to come up with an answer. If we think we're coming up with an answer, we just let go of that. What we're doing is finding a resting place in non-conceptuality because we can't actually answer the question. It takes us straight to non-conceptuality. It takes us straight to not being able to define the object versus the perceiver. Just resting there. We cannot say where the seeing is taking place, and we rest in that. So now, if there is a sound that you can hear, it could be my voice or any other sound you may be hearing. Same thing, we notice the sound and we ask, where is the hearing taking place? Is it at the source of the sound? Is it in our ear? Is it inside our head? We just rest and listen. And we cannot say where the hearing of the sound is taking place. And that's fine, and we rest in that. This is like opening up a door to a place where we can't conceptualize, where we can't answer, we can't figure it out, we can't know, and that's where we want to rest. Feeling comfortable with not knowing, with not being able to say, but just resting there in that looking, that awareness. And then our last question, who is experiencing this when we're examining our seeing and our looking and our imagining? Who or what is experiencing this? And again, we just ask and look. We don't try to figure it out or define anything. We rest in the looking. And then finally, we let go even of the looking, and we're just resting, just in a state of complete receptivity. And when we're doing this kind of meditation, it's taught that it's helpful to have the gaze straight ahead. Again, you can do whatever's comfortable. Sometimes I do it with my eyes closed if I'm tired. But it's most effective, according to our teachers, if we look gaze straight ahead in an unfocused way when we're looking at the mind. So now within this vast, expansive, limitless awareness that we are resting in right now, vividly present, we remember that all of vast, limitless space is filled with sentient beings who are suffering. And we begin to breathe in their suffering. We develop the wish to free them from this suffering, a heartfelt wish. And we breathe in their suffering. Let it dissolve into the vastness of our Buddha nature, the vastness of space. And breathe out to them whatever they need, happiness, healing, and so forth. We'll do this for a few rounds. You can do that on every set of breaths or every few set of breaths. But not losing touch with that sense of limitless awareness, relative bodhicitta within ultimate bodhicitta. And we'll take a moment to think that all beings, including ourselves, are free from all suffering, completely filled with happiness and joy and peace. And we're all completely awake, and we can take a moment to rejoice in that, really feeling it in our heart, in our body. And then letting go of all visualization, all conceptuality, going back to resting in that place where we can't say. And now coming back to our class, already in progress. So does anybody have any questions about the meditation before we go on to chant the verses? Okay, looks like no questions. So I'll share the screen. And we'll do all the verses. I'm actually gonna record this so that I can post it, like all of the verses to date, because people have asked for that and I've never gotten around to it. So I'm not going to give any commentary in the verses as we go through them today. I think everybody knows all the sections now anyway. This precious human life so hard to find, its freedoms and resources like a boat to navigate samsara's endless sea. And set myself and other beings free, for that without distraction day and night, to study, contemplate, and meditate, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. While those I love can stir up a tsunami, and those I hate can burn me up like fire, when I don't care I lose my moral compass, and dark delusion permeates my mind, to leave behind my habits and reactions, this homeland where I've dwelt from life to life, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. When I avoid conditions that disturb me, emotional afflictions lose their strength. When there are no distractions to engage me, my dharma practice grows to fill the space. Awareness knowing rupa clarifies, and certainty in dharma dawns and thrives, on solitude and silence to rely. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. Old friends I've known as long as I remember, One day we'll have to go our separate ways. Material possessions I've worked hard for will be enjoyed by someone else one day. This consciousness, a guest, will leave my body. The guest house where for all my life it stayed. To let go of attachment to this lifetime, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. When I'm with friends who strengthen the three poisons, reflection, study, meditation fade, kindness and compassion are forgotten, and I'm caught up again in worldly aims. Not following the friends who harm my practice, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. When I rely on spiritual friends, my faults and negative behaviors wane, constructive qualities and skills expand, just like the brilliance of the waxing moon. To hold off authentic friends like this more dear than even my own physical welfare, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. Who can the worldly deities protect? Themselves imprisoned in samsara's jail, the three jewels which embody freedom's path, reliable protection without fail, to seek refuge in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. The sufferings of the three lower realms, these states of mind so difficult to bear, according to the teachings of the sage, are the result of actions that cause harm. Therefore, even with my own life at stake, from harmful actions always to refrain, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. Like drops of dew upon each blade of grass, the three realms' happiness evaporates. In contrast, the supreme and highest state of liberation doesn't ever change. To strive in all our efforts just for that, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. My mother's each and every sentient being, since time without beginning cared for me. How can I be happy while they're suffering? I must get to work to set them free, to cultivate the mind of full awakening. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. The source of every single suffering is wishing for my happiness alone, while focusing on others' benefit gives rise to Buddhahood awakening. Because of this, to genuinely trade my happiness for others' suffering, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. If someone driven by intense desire steals all my wealth or instigates the theft, to dedicate to them from all three times my wealth, good deeds, and merit everything, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. Though I've not done the slightest thing that's wrong, without a cause someone cuts off my head, to generate compassion in my heart and take upon myself all their misdeeds, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. If someone slanders me and spreads the word, maligning me throughout the universe, to pay them back I fill my heart with love, extolling their good traits and character, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. If someone tells a crowd my hidden faults and speaks of me with undisguised contempt, to see them as my spiritual friend and bow sincerely with respect to them, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. If someone I've cared for as my own child turns on me as their worst enemy, then like a mother when her child is ill, to shower them with more love than before, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. If someone, my inferior or peer, through pride disparages and puts me down, to honor them as I would my teacher and place them reverently on my crown, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. When I've lost everything and everyone abuses me and treats me with contempt, I'm stricken by disease and very sick. On top of that, a demon's in my head to take on all the suffering of beings completely free of all discouragement. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. Though I've achieved the pinnacle of fame and the whole world bows down to me in awe, I'm rich beyond my very wildest dreams. Whatever money buys, I have it all. To see that there's no essence in success and never think I'm better than the rest. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. If I don't tame my inner enemy, the poison of aggression, anger, hate, then outer enemies just multiply. No matter how to vanquish them, I fight to tame my own mind with an army of the forces of compassion, kindness, love. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. Sense pleasures and desire are like salt water. The more I drink them in, the more I crave. Therefore, the moment that attachment stirs, to drop it right away without a pause, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. All appearances are my own mind. Mind's nature from the start is concept free. To know exactly this and not engage in grasping signs of subject and object, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. Sorry for the slight pause here. Okay. All right, so we're going to go back. And I didn't think to send an email asking you to review verse 2 today. We're going to chant verse 2 three times because that's our review verse this week. And then we'll chant our verse for this week three times and then on to the teaching. While those I love can stir up a tsunami, and those I hate can burn me up like fire. When I don't care, I lose my moral compass, and dark delusion permeates my mind. To leave behind my habits and reactions, this homeland where I've dwelt from life to life, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. So this is about leaving our homeland being our habitual emotional reactivity to things that we feel aversion to, things that we feel attraction to, and then ignorance, just the state of being in confusion and indifference. And that is the second practice, one of the basic preliminary practices of all of the entire bodhisattva path. While those I love can stir up a tsunami, and those I hate can burn me up like fire. When I don't care, I lose my moral compass, and dark delusion permeates my mind. To leave behind my habits and reactions, this homeland where I've dwelt from life to life, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. I actually just realized that this actually makes a very elegant continuation of the metaphor from verse 1. The boat of our precious human existence is now leaving the port. We got in it, like Ken MacLeod's whole commentary about verse 1 was what's going to make us get in the boat? Well, we got in the boat in verse 1. We're going to study, contemplate, and meditate so we can follow the path, and now we're actually allowing ourselves to leave the shore. So I think that's actually very beautiful. While those I love can stir up a tsunami, and those I hate can burn me up like fire, when I don't care, I lose my moral compass, and dark delusion permeates my mind. To leave behind my habits and reactions, this homeland where I've dwelt from life to life, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. And then looking ahead to verse 3, which we will review for our next week, where are we heading in that boat? We're heading to a place of solitude, seclusion of body and mind, so that we can actually embark upon the path. That's the great thing about studying these verses over and over, is that each time we see things that we may have missed before. So verse 22, we're going to chant this one three times again. This is our second and final week on verse 22, to remain free from subject-object fixation. All appearances are my own mind. Mind's nature from the start is concept-free. to know exactly this and not engage in grasping signs of subject and object. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. All appearances are my own mind. Mind's nature from the start is concept free. To know exactly this and not engage in grasping signs of subject and object. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. All appearances are my own mind. Mind's nature from the start is concept free. To know exactly this and not engage in grasping signs of subject and object. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. So we're all back now. Anybody have any questions or comments or anything to share before we start talking about the verse again? All right. So again, we have Mark has a question. Okay, Mark, I'm unmuting you.
Yeah, I was just noticing this in verse two, mm-hmm. where it says, I'm abandoning my habits and reactions. The homeland, does that really mean that? Is like, that's where I usually dwell, is in my habits and reactions, so I'm going to leave them?
I guess I would say that the whole point of Dharma is to help us disengage from our habitual patterns of emotional reactivity, pleasant and unpleasant, anger and desire and so forth. So yeah, the idea is that when you are a Buddha, you're free of all that. You're completely free of any emotional reactivity. So that's our ultimate goal. Obviously, still in the preliminaries, in the second step of the Bodhisattva preliminaries, we probably can't do it all at once. But I think that is the idea that we're setting sail now. You know, we've determined we're no longer going to dwell in emotional reactivity.
Yeah, there we go.
That's what I was through whatever process it takes.
Okay.
So what were you saying?
No, that's what I was wondering. That's exactly what, we're not going to dwell in those patterns. We're going to leave our home of those patterns and
Yeah, and it doesn't mean that we're going to become sticks of wood, you know, like that. My daughter said that that's the way she envisioned, like, the path. She's not a Buddhist, but that's what she thought we were aiming for, was like complete neutrality, like we never feel anything again. And I don't think that's it. You look at realized teachers, they're pretty jolly, happy, feeling people, full of compassion and love and enjoyment of things, but they don't get angry. Usually,
yeah.
They're not, you know, I mean, and it's not that they could never express anger even, because they do. We call it wrath because we assume that they're in control of this emotion and they're choosing to present that way because we're not getting it the other way. That's why we have the protector deities, because we don't always get the peaceful instructions. I forgot what my train of thought was, but anyway, hopefully that was helpful.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. Not worth going back and trying to dig that up again. All right, Kathy. Kathy, I think you're unmuted.
Okay. I think it also might mean that I think when I first saw the Dalai Lama and he was talking to a group of Tibetans individually, you know, he's meeting them, they were coming up in a line. Mm-hmm. And as each one, I was able to watch him quite closely. It was a small venue, and he would, whatever he was doing, it was in the moment. He would sob.
Yes, yes.
Respond, and then he would laugh and laugh and laugh. And then the next one would come, and you could tell by his face, it just got, you know, it was sad again, and he would cry, you know, but it was always in the moment. And That blew me away.
Yeah.
That he could change. He never holds on to anything.
Yes.
And that's my goal.
That's lovely. That is so well put. You're very observant. I'm glad you had that opportunity. And I want to say, any of us who have seen the Dalai Lama teach, I think he bursts into tears at least once a teaching. Because he feels it in his heart, the suffering of beings. Like, he'll be talking about the suffering of beings and he'll just start crying. not an emotionless state we're going for. It's a state in which, and he's probably not choosing to cry, but there's a spontaneity to it. Anyway, we'll sort it out, you know, as we travel the path, it will all become clearer. But this is like our instructions for like how to envision what it is that we're doing. And what we're envisioning here is leaving behind sort of our slavery, our enslavement to our emotional impulses, like where anger comes up and you can't help just lashing out at somebody. We want to be able to not do that. We want to be able to feel it starting to come up and then catch it right then and apply the Ken MacLeod, you know, description of basically Vipassana and meditation. Like, we want to be able in our daily life, in the middle of emotional turmoil, like something coming at us, to see it as it arises and be able to go, where is that located in that moment? Where is that located? I can't say where it is. I can't say what this anger even is. And by then you've lost the impulse. So that's what we're trying to do. And we will not succeed easily. It will take a lot of work. So we will be very, very patient with ourselves every day. Anybody else? All right, so today we're going to be looking at our verse and at the Dingo Chensei commentary, and a little bit of commentary also at the end from Kenpo Sultram Jamso Rinpoche, who we bring in every once in a while. So all, just to look at the verse one more time, all appearances are my own mind. I mean, this is meant quite literally. Like, you see, I'm looking at my glasses. These are my reading glasses. I'm looking at my regular glasses sitting, you know, over there, and it's like, in some sense, that's my mind. I mean, they have an existence. I can pick them up, but all of this is taking place in our mind somehow. So we're taking this quite literally, all appearances, meaning everything that happens to us, every object that we perceive, every thought and emotion that we have is all mind. It doesn't have an independent, inherent existence of its own. And the easiest analogy for this, as we touched upon last week, and which is what Kenpo Sultram Jamso Rinpoche is going to talk about, is the analogy of the dream, where you can go through a whole lifetime of intense experience in your sleep, and you wake up, and sometimes you're still in that experience, you're still feeling those emotions. But where did that take place? You can't say, because it didn't take place in the outer world. Like, no way. Like, every single person in your dream is in your head, but you're experiencing them as if they were outside your head, as if they were external to you. And with a dream, we know that that's not true. So we're encouraged to look at all of our experience as if it could be like that. Did somebody have their hand up, Chet? I'm unmuting you now. Okay.
Something that really helped me, and I think it kind of came out of the discussion we were having last week, is when I used to teach perception as part of psychology, how much perception is really a construction of our mind. And I was, because there's something he's in the reading where he talks about looking at something, and using the whole practice of looking that MacLeod does. So, you know, like, whatever is out there, we don't really see what's really there.
Yeah.
You know, when we look out there, it's upside down in our vision, and we only have three color cones, and we don't really see dimension. I mean, we learn to see all this, and when you start taking it apart, you realize, wow, this is really my mind creating this whole world. But I guess I had to be like a doubting Thomas. I had to kind of come through it from a more kind of scientific perspective. And when I started doing that, thinking about it, I finally got it. I went, oh, okay, I get this. I can understand that.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing that from the psychology point of view. And Deidre was bringing that in last week, that right. Science is confirming a lot of the things that we experience here as Buddhism. And even the concept of emptiness. You know, if you look at science, like, every solid surface is really like mostly empty space, you know, but we perceive it as a solid thing. So, I think it helps. As Deidre was saying last week, as Chet is pointing out this week, it helps to have science confirming this, like, because for one thing, that's language that we understand as Westerners. That's how we were raised, is to believe science. And so when science confirms what we're hearing from the Buddha's teachings, and they come together. It's really very reinforcing, and it also helps us to understand, to literally, as Chet was saying, to really understand the meaning of it.
I also don't know if you've ever had that that reverse image they used to show you when you used to take like intro to psychology class, like, is there a woman there or is there a glass there? Which one are you seeing? What's foreground and what's background? And again, it's the mind's really just playing a game with whatever image is out there and how you perceive it.
Yeah, and it goes back and forth. It's hard to see the two things at one time. Right. Yeah, but whichever one you see, you're really seeing it. Like, it's really that.
Right, which is that exercise about what you look at is what you then take apart. And then realize what you're looking at is just another image of something else anyway.
Yeah. Okay, anybody else have a comment or a question? All right, so all appearances are my own mind, completely literal. And then what is mind? The next line is, what is our mind? Mind from the beginning is concept free. Like, mind itself has no concepts. And if I don't know how much of Dingo Chenzi Rinpoche's commentary we'll get through today because it's long, but he talks about, oh gosh, I lost my train of thought again. I'm going to have to retire soon from teaching. No, actually, we can't say, right? We're just going to rest in that state of like not being able to conceptualize what we were going to say next. Mind's nature from the start is concept free. Oh, I know. Okay, so he was talking about how we tend to think of our mind as the thinking. Like, our thoughts and emotions are what we think of as our mind, but that's not it. Our mind is free of all of that. That's an appearance that, well, it is our mind because we just learned that all appearances are our mind. But mind itself isn't, like, those are just something that, yeah, that's really a hard thing to say, so I'm not going to waste a lot of time on it. But mind also is free of all of that. Mind is, well, the classic example that's given in pointing out instructions is a mirror. And Ken MacLeod just wrote a lovely thing. He has a newsletter called Unfettered Mind. If you Google Ken MacLeod, he has a fabulous website with all kinds of teachings, audio on it, audio teachings, and he sends out a newsletter. And he said that it took him a long time to understand what that meant. Like, you know, they'll show you the mirror and say that, you know, your experience is really like a reflection in the mirror. And he was going, but yeah, but what is it that's being reflected? And he said, but he realized after many, many years that that's not the point. What's being reflected isn't the point. The point is that what you're actually looking at is a mirror. Like, when you look at a mirror, you're looking at your face or whatever, but what you're actually seeing is a mirror. And you don't see the mirror because you're focused on the reflections in the mirror. So we'll, you know, just put that into your chain of things to be contemplated. But so the mind itself is not the things that we're seeing and experiencing, although they are also part of mind. So to know exactly this, meaning this is all we need to know, precisely what we need to know is that everything is mind and that mind is free of conceptualization. And by knowing that, then we can refrain from engaging in seeing things as being external objects. To know exactly this and not engage in grasping signs of subject and object, just because it appears to be outside of us, doesn't mean that it is. Don't get distracted by that. It's not an outside object. It is your mind. And so in meditation, we just keep coming back to that, like letting go of that mechanism that keeps seeing it in a conceptual way. And that's all you have to do, keep letting go. As soon as it arises, you just let it go. And that way you can begin to rest in a state of non-dual perception, which is apparently the way things really are. And you can, anybody can experience this, like in a session of meditation. Yes, Deidre, I'm unmuting you. All right.
I think one of our teachers that really helped me a lot with that was Mir Rinpoche, because he is very lighthearted in giving these kinds of teachings that are so deep and profound. But one of the things he brought up was that when you walk into a room and you completely forgot what you walked in there for, like a senior moment,
yeah,
he said, rejoice.
Yes.
Because You're actually experiencing the non-conceptual mind.
Yes. And the other examples, we talked about a couple of them last week. Like anytime you forget, I mean, that's like when I lose my train of thought, it's like, you're there. Like, just stay there. Just get the train back.
Rejoice.
I'm not talking to a bunch of people who are kind of counting on you to say something. But when you sneeze, like you have a moment. When somebody startles you or anything startles you, you have a moment. Like your mind goes non-conceptual for a moment. And if you can recognize that, you can stay there and appreciate it and not be all upset that something startled you, for example. That loud noise, you suddenly appreciate that loud noise because it propelled you into exactly where you want to be, how you want to see things. Anybody else? Yeah, Deirdre, did you have anything else?
No, just wanted to share that.
Yes, thank you. All right, then we will look at Dingo Chense Rinpoche for a while, and then in the last few minutes, we'll look at a very short excerpt from, well, actually, Kempo Tsultrum Jumpso's Rinpoche's commentaries are always just a couple of paragraphs, but he has a pretty good pithy one on this. So we're on page 137 if you're looking at the book, which you don't need to be. And he starts out by identifying that we are now entering into absolute bodhicitta. Gosh, how far back were we in relative bodhicitta? I'm going to just take a second. I didn't do this before, to look at the textual outline. Don't forget the handy-dandy textual outline that starts on page 39. So relative bodhicitta started on with verse 11. All right. Everything before then was the seven preliminary verses and the three stages of the path verses. And then with verse 11, we begin relative bodhicitta. So that's 11 through 21. That is like, that's what, 11 verses on relative bodhicitta. And we only have three on ultimate bodhicitta. So that tells us something. Ultimate bodhicitta is simple. There's not a lot to say about it, although this is a long commentary to help us understand it. So we're embarking now on absolute bodhicitta, which is only going to be three verses long. I have a note to myself to talk about the Heart Sutra as when we do this section, but I'm not going to, certainly not today. But if you chant the Heart Sutra, if you have the Heart Sutra, read it. This is what it's about. So he says, the practice of absolute bodhicitta consists of two things. One, the meditation practice of remaining in a state free of conceptual elaborations. That means chains of thought, without any clinging. Don't glom on to any thought that comes into your mind. Don't cling to it. Don't grasp onto it. Don't make a thought chain. Just letting thoughts come and go. So that's first the meditation. That's the first part of absolute bodhicitta. And the second part, the post-meditation practice, which means anytime we're not in formal meditation, means our daily life from the moment we get off the chair or cushion to the moment we come back to it. The post-meditation practice of abandoning any belief in the objects of desire and aversion as truly existing. And that'll be verses 23 and 24. So 22 is the actual meditation session. This is what we do on the cushion or the chair. So we read a little bit of the beginning last time, but we're going to do it again because it's a really important underpinning for understanding what we're talking about here. He says, the many different perceptions of everything around you in this life arise in your mind. You could contemplate that one a lot. Contemplate it as you go through life. Like, this perception is arising in my mind. This perception is actually, where is this taking place? You could just go through it with the Ken MacLeod, you know, meditation. Like every experience you have, you could be saying, where is this taking place? Like this rain that I'm experiencing, which is not raining here, I'm making that up, but the daffodils across my yard, you know, where is that taking place? And remind yourself that it's taking place in your mind. And just let it be, because you can't explain that. You can't elaborate upon that. Look at your relationships with others, for example. And this is another thing we can examine constantly, in our post-meditation, even though this is the meditation explanation. Look at your relationships with others. You perceive some people in a positive way, friends, relatives, benefactors, protectors, while there are others whom you perceive as enemies, those who criticize you, defame you, beat you, fool you, or swindle you. And this is instantaneous. He says the process starts with the senses, through which the mind perceives various forms, sounds, smells, tastes, and feelings. As the mind becomes aware of those objects outside, it categorizes them. Those that it finds pleasant, it is attracted to, while those that it finds unpleasant, it tries to avoid. And this is not a thought process for most of us. This is verse two. This is our immediate, compulsive, unconscious reaction to things. So when we say that we're going to leave it behind, the first step is to unravel that process and to see it happening. Like, this thing that I'm perceiving is extremely unpleasant and I'm already swerving to avoid without even thinking of it, that's not an inherent quality of the thing itself. So, right. The mind that suffers from not getting the pleasant things at once and from having to experience the unpleasant things it wants to avoid, it is always busy running after some pleasant situation or other that it really wants to enjoy, or trying to escape some unwanted one that it finds difficult and unpleasant. And if we were to actually pay attention to this in a mindful way, in some continuous way, we would see that it's happening constantly, constantly. That is our life, is trying to avoid things we don't want to run into or experience, and trying and going after the things we do want, from like a TV show to a meal to a what we're going to wear to our next door neighbor to the weather to everything. We're constantly engulfed in these reactions. But these experiences of things as pleasant or unpleasant are not functions intrinsically belonging to the objects you perceive. They arise only in the mind. Take as an example the process of perceiving visual form, something we see. The object is a particular form in the outer world, like my glasses. The organ that senses it is the eye over here, glasses over there, eye over here. And that which perceives the image and categorizes it is consciousness. And that's the process I think Chet was referring to. if you see a beautiful person, a dear relative, or a sacred statue, you feel glad. If you see something ugly or some ill-intentioned person come to ridicule or attack you, you feel upset, anxious, or angry. All these perceptions arise in the mind itself. That's the key point to know. Everything is coming from the mind. These perceptions are triggered by the object perceived, but they do not themselves exist in that object, nor do they originate anywhere else outside the mind. And it almost doesn't matter how far we get in the commentary before we run out of time, because every word of this commentary is precious and sort of contains the whole thing. I wanted to share a story here. I don't think I've shared this one before, of many, many years ago, probably like, you know, around 1980, driving through Hoboken, New Jersey at night. And I got behind a car that had this really ugly decal in the rear window of a rose. Like this really hideous pink, or maybe it was red, rose decal. My immediate reaction was, why would anybody choose to have an ugly decal in their car window? And it was just this moment. I had met Rinpoche by then. I'd met the Buddhist teachings. And it was just this epiphany, like, well, they wouldn't. They see it as a really beautiful decal of a rose. And I'm seeing it as a really ugly decal of a rose. They wouldn't have it in their car window if they thought it was ugly. So that was sort of a very preliminary glimpse for me of like how we think things, we impute qualities to things, but the qualities are not in the things themselves. And even though, yes, Valerie.
Did you judge the people in that car based on the ugly decal?
Well, yeah, I thought they were like, they must be stupid people or something. They must be like, you know, how could they have an ugly decal?
And now you wouldn't do that.
I wouldn't, if I, once I thought about it, I wouldn't do that. I can't say I wouldn't have that moment. I have that moment all the time. But I catch myself, man, you know, like, how could that person vote for that other person? You know, well, they see things differently than I do. And I think I'm right and I think they're wrong, but that's my imputation. It's really hard when you start to apply it to things that are very close to your heart, you know, social injustice and so forth. And some things happen that are wrong, you know.
Or American democracy.
Yeah. So the beauty of this, like the Rose Decal story, or, you know, especially of Dingo Chenzi's commentary here, is that we can learn to apply it to those big heartfelt things. Like, we're so sure of our ground and that the other person is completely wrong, completely stupid, completely, you know, malicious or whatever. And we can start to go, that's in my own mind. Like, in some way, that's, if we see them beating up a person, that's still in our mind, but we go break it up. You know, we do what we can. Because things do happen in the world that need to be helped. There's relative reality, but we're looking at ultimate reality here. This is the ultimate reality view, is that it's happening in your own mind. And it's important to understand that even if something's happening that we have to intervene in, or we have to go out and vote, we're not going to go out and not vote. We're not going to not vote because we think everything's equal and it's all in our mind. I mean, you still want to benefit. You know, you want to support things that seem to really benefit people, whether you're seeing it rightly or wrongly. You can't necessarily know that, but you just do your best. And you deal with relative reality, knowing that ultimate reality is also part of the equation. That it's only our own mind. Anybody else? All right, we'll continue with Dingo Chenzi Rinpoche. Generally, mind is the slave of its own biased perceptions. Dividing everything into pleasant or unpleasant, it constantly tries to experience what is pleasant and to get rid of what is not, blind to the fact that this is not the way to achieve happiness and avoid suffering. Blind ignorance drives the mind constantly to generate feelings of like and dislike. You engage in endless ordinary worldly activities with no more durability than drawings on water. How much energy do we expend on things that are completely meaningless? And based on our likes and dislikes, what we find pleasant or unpleasant. Preoccupied entirely by these distractions, you exhaust your life and squander this precious human existence with all the freedoms and advantages that you now enjoy. So again, this is something that we can experiment specifically with this, like with this perception of things as pleasant or unpleasant, to be pursued or to be avoided. We can catch ourselves in that act, like, this smells really bad, I'm gonna go over there, and you could stop and you could continue to smell the terrible smell and see if you could experience it without that reaction of pleasant or unpleasant. Like, can it be just a smell? You could do it with anything that's unpleasant. Pain. It's actually a really excellent way to work with pain, especially when you can't get away from the pain, is you see if you can scale it back to just sensation. Like, where does the pleasant or unpleasant, where does that, what triggers that? Where does that originate? And can you get back to something like equanimity? Like, it's just a sensation, it's just a smell. And it's not an intellectual thing. You're just pausing and seeing without, you know, a process of thinking necessarily, if you can experience it differently without the overlay. Without the sort of emotionally reactive overlay. So cultivating, in short, equanimity. When we catch ourselves finding something really wonderful or really horrible, can we find equanimity with that, just even for a moment? So he goes on, the mind thus contrives everything. So the only thing to do is to master the mind. We want to go find the man behind the curtain and work with that. As Talopa taught Naropa, and this is a very, very famous verse. And Angela, did you have something to say, or are you just moving your arm? Okay. Very famous verse from Tulopa, teaching his student Naropa. It is not what you perceive that binds you. It is your clinging to it that binds you. Cut through your clinging, Naropa. And the clinging is the emotional reactivity. I like that, I don't like that. That's what draws us into experiencing things as sort of objectively existing and being separate from us. And that's traps us in this dualistic perception. It's the clinging, not the thing. If you master your mind, it will remain naturally concentrated, peaceful, and aware. How do we do that? That's meditation. First, shine, learning to place our attention and stay with it there, and then learning to turn that in Laktang or Vipassana, turn that to the mind and really recognize and realize the mind itself. If you master your mind, it will remain naturally concentrated, peaceful, and aware. That means no matter what's happening. You will even be able to wander around in a crowd without being distracted and carried away by desire or aversion. But if you have no mastery over your mind and are influenced and conditioned by your habitual tendencies, even in the quiet of an isolated retreat, your thoughts will follow one upon another like ripples on water. Memories of past events will well up vividly in your mind, as will plans, decisions, and speculation about your future. You will spend your whole time running after thoughts and concepts, a lot of mental activity with no benefit at all for your practice. So we have to do a certain amount of running around. Even Lama Norla Rinpoche had to do some running around and taking care of things in the world. But his mind was never sucked into thinking that it was real. So a mind that has been brought under control is indeed the only true source of happiness. But to master your mind, you need to know more about how it works. So what is this mind? And so this whole chapter is basically, you know, it's a Vipassana teaching. It's and beyond Vipassana. Like, Vipassana is just the way to approach starting to experience the mind. And then you're in nature of mind once you've recognized it and through practice begun to stabilize it. Then you experience everything through that filter. It's not really a filter, it's the unfiltering. So what is this mind? When you see a pleasant form, a friend or a relative, a feeling of happiness arises and you think, what a joy to meet them. This is mind in one aspect. Another aspect of the mind is the feeling of outrage and fury that might arise when you see someone who dislikes you and accuses you of stealing or being dishonest. All such reactions are just thoughts. But once they arise in your mind, they can expand and give rise to further thoughts, becoming very powerful. Once hatred arises, it may increase to the point where you are ready to kill. Once attachment and desire are kindled, you may soon be ready to do anything and give every penny you have to get whatever it is you desire so much, whether it is a woman or a man or some other object. Look at what is happening, and you will see that it is all just thoughts and nothing more. Everything you perceive is like that. So we experience everything through the filter of our thoughts. And our thoughts are just, you know, we're into the skandhas again. Thoughts is like the fourth skandha. We're talking mostly here about the second skandha. You know, the first skandha is the encounter, like the perception of an object. The second skandha is the reaction to it as pleasant or unpleasant. I like it, I don't like it, I don't care about it. Third skandha is where you start to define what it is. And the fourth skandha is when you're caught up in thinking about it. So all just thoughts. Everything that you experience is all just thoughts and nothing more, because we experience it through the skandhas, through this incorrect correct perception of our solidity as an individual separate from everything that we're experiencing. And so in ultimate bodhicitta, we're closing that gap and we're getting back to, like, beyond even the first skandha, where there's no separation between subject and object. And we're going to turn to Kenpo Sultan Jonsu Rinpoche in a few minutes to define that a little bit more. So ultimate bodhicitta is the antidote to all of this. Ultimate bodhicitta is the antidote to verse two, being caught up in emotional reactivity, caught up in a tsunami or burning up like fire. At present, you are seeing me sitting here, and this is Dingo Chenzi Rinpoche talking about him teaching, but you see me reading Dingo Chenzi. And you are thinking, he is teaching the Dharma. I had better listen to what he's saying. These are thoughts too. You think there is something solid in front of you because you have perceived an object and various different feelings are arising in relation to it. TV's the same, right? Like, we all start off thinking like there's little people in front of us in this box. We don't think that now, obviously, but that's what little children think, is there are people in the box. And it turns out that that's not the way it is. We're perceiving something as a solid object that has no solidity whatsoever. So the process begins, as I have said, with sense perception. There is one consciousness that perceives visual forms, another that perceives sounds, another that perceives taste, and so forth. But these are not yet what we call thoughts. They are merely basic perceptions. Then when you come into contact with something, a train of thoughts is triggered. If, for instance, you have just heard someone praising you, you start to feel elated and to think how your reputation is increasing. Or if someone has just insulted you, you start to feel annoyed. We can catch ourselves in the act of this. But these are just thoughts. If we catch ourselves getting puffed up because we hear somebody saying something nice about us, or getting all, you know, angry because somebody insulted us behind our back, it really helps to go back to ultimate bodhicitta and think, this is all just thoughts. Drop the storyline, as Pema Chodron says. To put it simply, the mind is just this random collection of thoughts. So that's another one to earmark as a, you know, you could do some intensive contemplation on this. The mind is just a random collection of thoughts. So past thoughts are dead. The countless thoughts that have arisen in your mind since sunrise have all gone. Can anybody remember what they were thinking about while they were eating lunch? If you've had lunch yet, or breakfast. How many thoughts have we had just in this day? And where are they? Future thoughts have not yet arisen, and what they will be is utterly unpredictable. Who knows what you are going to think about from now until midnight? So you are left with only the present thought as something you could investigate. Let us examine such a present thought, and we're getting into Vipassana again here, you know, like the analytical meditation of looking at the mind and asking what are its characteristics. He says, you may be thinking, for example, I am cold. Is that thought in your skin? You're probably feeling it, and you feel like you're feeling it in your skin, right? Is it in your skin, or is it in your bones or nerves? Like, what is it? And getting back to what Chet was saying about the whole sort of scientific process of how we process sensory input. Like, is it your skin? Is it your bones or your nerves that are feeling cold? Is it perhaps in your heart or your brain or your liver? Is it somewhere else? If you think there is something somewhere, then does this feeling cold, does it have a shape? Square, round, or triangular? Does it have a color? Red, blue, black, yellow, or white? Or what? Or is it just a rainbow in the sky that has suddenly appeared because of the conjunction of various circumstances? No matter how much you look, there is nothing that you can point your finger at and say, here is the thought. And the reason you cannot do it is because the nature of thought is empty. There is nothing but emptiness. I'm probably going to have to start skipping now. okay, I'm just going to continue with the next paragraph. When a rainbow appears vividly in the sky, you can see its beautiful colors, yet you could not wear it as clothing or put it on as an ornament. It arises through the conjunction of various factors, but there is nothing about it that can be grasped. Likewise, thoughts that arise in the mind have no tangible existence or intrinsic solidity. There is no, and this is the crux here, there is no logical reason why thoughts, which have no substance, should have so much power over you, nor is there any reason why you should become their slave. So we could ask ourselves, how did that happen? And there's lots of teachings on it, but the point is just to recognize that basic fact that everything that's upsetting us or everything that's driving us wild with desire is just our own thoughts. It's not the thing itself. And anybody who's ever been in love and then been not in love with the same person, married, divorced, you can see it's not in the person. Like, love is when, like, you just overlook all their faults or you think that they're just part of their charm. And then not being in love is when it all drives you crazy and you think it's, you know, how could they do that? How can they be like that? And if you watch your mind, it turns on a dime, like, all the time about things. Okay, so now there's a whole section that addresses the question that John asked. I'm not sure if it was in this class, actually, or the KDC class, about the past and the present and the future, but I think we're going to skip that part. It's just at the bottom of page 141, though, he's going to lead us into something really important. When you look at the mind, it seems superficially that past thoughts lead to present thoughts, and present thoughts lead to future ones. But if you examine these thoughts more closely, you will see that none of them truly exist. Past thoughts don't exist. Future thoughts don't exist. Present thoughts don't exist. To formulate the existence of something that has no existence at all is called delusion. So that's it. That's like the beginning of the jewel ornament of liberation, is why do we suffer? Because we see things in a confused way. We suffer because of our delusion. We suffer because we think something has a solid existence that doesn't have a solid existence. That is the whole problem right there. And that's ignorance. It is only your lack of awareness and your grasping that make thoughts seem to have some kind of reality. If thoughts had any inherent existence in the absolute nature of mind, they should at least have a form or be located somewhere, but there is nothing. And here, now, top of page 142, this is a pointing out instruction. In this context, you know, I don't think it's meant to be. It's just part of the explanation, but these very words are often encountered in pointing out instructions when a teacher actually points out to you the nature of your own mind. So they've led you to seeing that, just as Dingo Chenzin Rinpoche has led us to seeing that when we analyze it, things don't really have an existence. They're like empty of any kind of solid characteristics. So we call that emptiness. And he said, however, that nothingness or emptiness is not just a blank emptiness like empty space. There is an immediate awareness present. And these are the two main aspects of the nature of mind, is the emptiness aspect, the openness aspect, the undefinable aspect, and the clarity aspect. He says the immediate awareness that's present, this is called clarity, or we sometimes call it luminosity. If someone gives you an apple, you are cheerful. I don't know if an apple does it these days. You know, it might need to be a candy bar. But if somebody gives you something you really would like to eat, a gallon of ice cream, a piece of pecan pie, you are cheerful. If a bee stings you, you feel pain. This is the clarity aspect of mind. So it's not all bad. It's clarity that allows us to feel things as pleasant or unpleasant, or to define them, or to develop thoughts about them. This clarity of mind or luminosity is like the sun illuminating the landscape and allowing you to see mountain, path, and precipice, where to go and where not to go. Although the mind does have this inherent awareness, to say there is a mind, quote unquote, is to give a label to something that also does not exist, to assume the existence of something that is no more than a name given to a succession of events. Another jewel in this commentary. What is the mind? It is a succession of events. And we've seen the same thing in Gampopa and in Yutoku. Mind is not a thing, it's a succession of events. It's an experience, it's a succession of experiences. And we solidify it into a subject who's experiencing and something that's being experienced. And we need to understand this in order to fully engage with the six paramitas which are coming up. So there's some things on the skandhas we're just going to skip now because I don't want to run out of time before we get to Kempo Soltram. All right. It's all that I'm assuming everybody's read it. So on page 144, Once you have been able to recognize the empty nature of mind, attachment and desire will not arise when your mind sees something beautiful, and hatred and repulsion will not develop whenever it comes across anything horrible or unpleasant. Doesn't mean we don't enjoy our experience. You know, we're not cutting off our emotions. We're just cutting off our clinging to our emotional reactions as something true and solid. Since these negative emotions no longer arise, the mind is no longer deceived or deluded. Karma is not accumulated, and the stream of suffering is cut. And this is also looking ahead to verses 23 and 24, which are how to deal with a perception of things that make us suffer and our perception of things that make us feel good. All right, I think we're going to stop here. Well, okay, so another pithy thought, though, on page 144. Indeed, try as you might, there is no way you will ever be rid of your attachment and hatred as long as you keep believing that they arise because of the external objects or circumstances to which they are connected. So coming back always to that first line of verse 22, all appearances are my own mind. Don't blame the appearance. Don't blame the object. Don't blame the situation. It's your mind that's making you see it as unpleasant and suffer from that. All right, we're going to stop there with Kenpo Tensei Rinpoche, and I'm just going to read the Kenpo Sulta Rinpoche. We'll have a couple of minutes after that, and we can, if anybody has any comments or questions. So from Kenpo Fulkim Jomso Rinpoche, his very short commentary on this verse, he says, briefly, dualistic appearances, let's see, okay, so I'm going to read his translation. This is really, I think, Michelle Martin's translation here based on his teaching. All appearances are your own mind, and mind's nature is originally beyond concept. Knowing that this is the precise nature of reality, to remain free from dualistic concepts is the practice of a bodhisattva. That is not a literal translation. Mine is much more literal, which I'm not saying it's better, but mine's more what the Tibetan says. It doesn't say dualistic concepts. It says signs of subject and object, which means the same thing. But because he's going to refer to dualistic appearances here. Briefly, dualistic appearances, the thing that we're remaining free from, refers to perceived and perceiver. The perceived is the outer perceived object, and the perceiver is the inner perceiving mind. The outer perceived object is merely one's mind. The thing that we're seeing, the clock, the pair of glasses, the person insulting us. The outer perceived object is merely one's own mind, a confused or delusive appearance arising from habitual tendencies. It is just like a dream in which objects seem to arise, yet nothing that appears has any true existence. If the outer perceived object is just like a dream appearance, then what can we say about the inner perceiving mind? So we've defined outer appearances as being mind. So what can we say about the mind, which is the next line? The text says that the mind itself, that is the true nature of mind, transcends all mental fabrications and has done so since the beginningless time. Mental fabrications are conceptuality. Anything that can be expressed, anything that can be put into words or in mental images, that's conceptuality, that's mental fabrication. So the mind itself, the true nature of mind, transcends all mental fabrications and has done so since beginningless time. You need to know this, he says. If you realize that perceived objects do not really exist and that the true nature of mind transcends all conceptuality, then you can give up clinging to dualistic appearances. Only then will you be able to accomplish this bodhisattva practice, namely verse 22. So, anybody have anything that they would like to say or to ask in our last few minutes? Okay, Joanne, I'm going to unmute you.
I just wanted to share, you had mentioned the Heart Sutra. Mm-hmm. I was able to place on my Kindle I could read it in about 2 hours or less, the commentary by, just forgive me if I mispronounce his name, a Zen Buddhist, Thich Nhat Hanh.
Oh yeah, Thich Nhat Hanh.
Yes, excellent. And he explores, there's a whole chapter, Long Live Emptiness. And I think I have a better understanding as far as what that means, and perhaps that might help some of the other participants.
Okay,
not in hard copy, it's solely on, I got it through Amazon and place it on my Kindle.
Okay, what's the name of it? Does it have a name?
I can email you.
Okay,
I will certainly email you at you.
Okay, yeah, email me. I will pass that information along.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Joanne. Anybody else? Okay, Angela, I'm unmuting you.
I was listening to a teaching from the Karmapa on Akshobhya, mm-hmm. and he was saying about the Shingpa, or about how we're when we recognize, when we get caught, to try to make it a game so that it's more fun instead of more burden.
Yeah.
So I've been doing that. It's actually more lighthearted than just sort of being more like, wow, this is how I really am, to going, okay, I'm playing Pokemon, catch them all now. So
Mark, I see that you have a question or an observation. Sorry, Angela, go ahead.
No, I'm done. That's good.
Okay. Yes, thank you. That's great. Yes, make a game of it. I think that's what I think of meditation as being like a video game a bit. Like, you know, watch all the thoughts and don't, you know, like you lose as soon as you respond to it or whatever. Yeah, and Pema Chodron also encourages us to be very gentle and humorous, you know, about it. So that, thank you for that recommendation. Okay, Mark, sorry, I'm unmuting you now.
Okay, thanks. Let's see, there was some part of what you were talking about, which is, I agree with all of it actually, but.
Disagreement is welcome. We can talk about that.
But I'd like to just make a point, and I've had some good explanation of this, is that there's not like a finality. You know, if you see mind free of concepts, it doesn't mean that the conceptual mind just stops functioning. You know, the fear really is liberated from it. It's kind of like you have to keep working it.
Yeah.
So that sometimes when these guys talk, they say, oh well, you know, it's like almost like this is the end of all suffering when you see the nature of mind. But I think you still have to keep going back to your conceptual mind keeps going, and along with your nature of mind.
Yeah. Well, conceptual mind is very useful. I mean, we call upon it constantly. We're just learning to train ourselves to be able to disengage when we want to.
Yeah.
And to understand that it's not ultimate reality. It's relative reality. Anything further, Mark?
Well, I could say one thing was along those lines. The analogy was like, it's like washing a dirty cloth or something like that. Mm-hmm. That the conceptual, you can look at the conceptual mind or like the whole mind is like a cloth with dirt on it. And you're washing that cloth until it's clean, you know?
Yes. Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Anybody else have anything they would like to say? Marilyn, I'm meeting you, hopefully. Yes.
You've already been bringing in Gompopa, but the single sentence from the wisdom chapter, the experiences are the experiencer,
right.
Which is so short and pithy and possibly difficult to grasp. In a nutshell, the half of what we're talking about. I mean, it's pretty concise, but I think that's what we're talking about here.
Yeah, the experience and the experiencer not being two separate things, but the experiencer is the experiences, or however he said it. I probably have it right here. Was that directly from Gompopa, or is that the Ringu Tulku?
It's, I think it's Ringu Tulku.
Yeah, it's actually the experience itself is the experiencer. It's on 117 of Ringu Tulku in the Wisdom chapter. This is, by the way, if you have not read this book, this is a fabulous book about the entire you know, path, Path to Buddhahood by Rinpoche Tulku. The experience itself is the experiencer. Same thing. He's talking about exactly the same thing. Thank you, Marilyn. Anybody else? Angela, you're on mute.
Are we actually trying to see both at the same time when we do that?
Both what?
Oh my gosh, I've lost it too, so I've got that great moment that we were talking about.
Yes.
Are we trying to see like what's in relative reality and then see what is really happening at the same time to make those decisions all the time?
Yeah, that's the goal. I think that that's the goal, is to always, to be able to operate in relative reality while never being separate from ultimate reality. In fact, there's so many poetic descriptions of like of realized lamas that are like that, that while never departing from the Dharmakaya, you perform all of these miracles for the benefit of beings. So it's like it's being in both at the same time. That's how I see it, and I think that that's how it's being taught, is we just think how it would transform our experience if we did the things we had to do. We dealt with the difficult people we have to deal with, but always remembering like that it's all taking place within this ultimate reality in which there's no subject, there's no object, there's no reality. It's all coming through the filter of our own thoughts. That would help us a lot to not get caught up in Shempa, as you said, Shempa being the Tibetan word for like being hooked, as Pema Chodron says, for that moment when you get, it's the word that means attachment, but caught by something.
I think that's why it's fun to say in my little video game version, as I say Shempa, you know.
Yeah, Shempa catching, and I think Pema Chodron has written about that too, like almost like a game of notice when you're being hooked. And I think that I made up like a, you want to notice when you're snagged before you're completely hooked. Like if you can catch it at the snag, then you don't get completely hooked. But it is good to approach it in a light-hearted way, because we're going to, if we set the high bar that we have to get this all the time, we're going to fail again and again and again. So we should enjoy that process and appreciate the one moment when you recognize it is worth all of the struggle. And then next time you're going to miss it again. Anybody else? All right, then. So I think I wrote this in my email that we will meet next week, which is the 15th, and we'll do hopefully verses 23 and 24. Even if I don't get time to translate them, we'll still do them. But we're going to not meet on the 29th. No, we're not going to meet on the 22nd, I'm sorry, because I'm going to be at KTC, and we're going to be preparing for the memorial service on the 25th. And probably, I think we should just say we're not going to meet on the 29th, because I'm not sure when I'm getting back home, and I don't want to take all of my books up there with me. I don't think I'll really have a lot of time. So probably, maybe we'll just leave it a little bit open, the 29th. We'll definitely be resuming by the April 5th, and we'll begin the six paramitas then. But whether we have a 1 week or a 2 week hiatus, use the time. I mean, you have your Thursday slot. If we're not meeting as a class, use that time to study and contemplate and meditate and really engage with this stuff. Chant your verses and just continue. You know, it doesn't have to be a vacation. You can take a vacation if you want, but you could continue to use the time very fruitfully. Because we don't always have to be moving forward. There's so much to look back at and take in again, which is why I'm looking, you know, at this reviewing one verse a week too, to really, because we're going to look back at those old verses now with a lot more understanding. So it's actually really helpful. Okay, anybody have any other things to say before we do our dedication? Okay. Just checking in, making sure there's nothing more from Mark. No, I think we got you, Mark. You got your comments. All right. So again, let's take a moment to go back into that state of meditation where we're resting in awareness in a straight, relaxed posture, letting our minds settle, taking a couple of mindful breaths. Very relaxed. letting go of thoughts. Looking at like who's experiencing this and realizing we can't say, and resting in that, not being able to say for a moment. And resting in the vastness, the limitlessness of our awareness, our clarity in emptiness. And remembering all the sentient beings who are suffering because they don't understand this, because they are caught in subject-object duality and thinking that everything is solid and real and permanent. And we are going to share any benefit from these teachings with all of those sentient beings. And we're going to chant these verses to remind ourselves. This merit may it win omniscience, defeat my faults, the enemy. Then from the rough and stormy sea of birth, old age, death, and disease, from this ocean of samsara, may I liberate all beings. They know things in their true existence, Kuntu, Zangpo, and Manjushri. To train myself in their example, I dedicate this practice fully. May every being through this practice completely gather merit and wisdom, attaining the two sacred bodies that merit and wisdom emanate. The blessings of the Buddha Kayas, the blessings of changeless Dharmata, the blessings of the steadfast Sangha, this dedication please fulfill. And then back to ultimate bodhicitta. And just hoping that everybody got the communication from KTC that they're welcoming stories or memories of Lama Norla Rinpoche that will be posted for people to read at the memorial service, and we also may collect them into some kind of a booklet or something that we can share with Sangha. So that information, there's like a form that they sent in their e-news to fill out, and I hope everybody will do that, and I'll get to read your stories. Anyways, all right, I'm going to unmute everybody, and we can say goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank
say
you.
Bye to Patrick. I know he has a 2:30 left put off. Oh, he's there. Oh, hey, Patrick. I thought you were gone. All righty. Bye, everybody, and I will see you next time.
Cool. Thank you.
Say bye to Clementine.
I will. Ah!